Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning here in New York. It really is a beautiful day. The sun is shining and the garden is calling. It's just so beautiful. So I hope you all are enjoying the beautiful spring weather wherever you are. And this Earth Day week, there were lots of ways that you could take action and get involved, and I'm going to share those with you in just a little bit. And also in a little bit, I will be inviting on this week's guest, who is Peter Carter. He's a retired physician and the founder of the Climate Emergency Institute. And I'm really excited to have him on. I met him at the Real Truth About Health conference last month, and his talk was really great. So I'm really excited to share his knowledge with all of you. But first, I want to tell you about some things and ways that you can take action. Today actually is a call-in day for the Green Light Long Island, and that's a program to support driver's license access for undocumented workers. And this is not only important for them, but it's important for all of us on the road. You don't want people driving who don't have driver's licenses out there. So it's really worth it to give access to everybody who is driving and make them legal for driving. So please call into your senators today, especially here on Long Island. If you are here or if you know anyone on Long Island, please let them know to call their senators and urge them to support the driver's license access for undocumented workers. Also, tomorrow there's a public hearing for the Farm Worker Fair Labor Act. And I've been talking about that quite a bit over the last couple of weeks, because the Farm Workers Fair Labor Act is something that automatically I said, yes, I'm right in there, because I support farm workers. And as a someone who cares about farm workers and rights for undocumented workers and for people that are, that don't have a large voice, I am really in there to support them. However, there are some problems with the Farm Worker Fair Labor Act that NOFA New York has brought out to people's attention. And there are many small farmers out there who are really barely making ends meet. And if they were forced to all of a sudden pay time and a half, that would really put them under. And they're already barely making ends meet. And so there's much information out there. And one of the things that NOFA New York is asking our legislators to do is to actually bring people back to the table to work out the issue with overtime pay and also housing issues and insurance. These are all issues that could really hurt the farmer. And I'm not talking about the industrial farmer that has millions of acres and lives in a penthouse in New York City. I'm talking about the small family farmer that's actually out there working on the farm who is barely making ends meet. So we just need to consider them as we consider the farm workers. So they're asking our legislators to bring people back to the table to really hash this out and come up with a resolution that will work for everybody. So that hearing is tomorrow. They're having a couple throughout the state, but the one on Long Island in Suffolk County is tomorrow at the Suffolk County Legislative Building from 2:30 to 5:30. If you can make it and come out in support of coming back to the table and working on some of these details, we'd really love to have you there. Also, some other things coming up, April 27th, Local Roots, which Wen Jie was a guest on my radio show last month. She runs a CSA where she actually goes to many different farms and curates a CSA package. And they're celebrating their 8th year in business, and they're having a party at the Crystal Lake in Brooklyn on April 27th from 7 to 10. It's very reasonable. I think it's $5 or $8 to go. So that should be fun to meet some local people. This coming weekend, April 27th and 28th, Dr. Maria Michael who is a Native American doctor, social worker, medicine person, will be doing a workshop and healing circles. And you can join that as well. That's Saturday, April 27th from 12 to 4. And I have links on my website for more information about that. May 2nd, Long Island Progressive Coalition is having their 40th gala at the Mansion in Oyster Bay. And also on May 4th, Riverkeeper, which is an organization that I have supported for many years, they are having their annual river sweep on May 4th. And that's an opportunity. There's, you know, locations, over 600 locations along the Hudson River where you can help clean up the shoreline, meet with other people that care about keeping the river clean. I mean, the Hudson River is so much cleaner now than it was when I was a child. And so much of that is because of Riverkeeper. So come out and support them and work with some other environmentalists in cleaning up our river. May 4th is also the Women's Diversity Summit. And so I will not be at the Riverkeeper because I will be at this Women's Diversity Summit preparing food for 350 women. There are 350 women coming. I am one of many people providing food for this event, but they reached out to me because they wanted some more vegan, gluten-free food. So that's what I'll be preparing. But it's all day at SUNY Old Westbury. And it's an organization that I was really attracted to. It's new. This is their second year having this summit. And it's bringing women together of all different socioeconomic and racial backgrounds to come together and to network and to move Long Island in a better direction. So come on out to that. Also on March 4th is March for Science, and that's taking place in New York City in Foley Square. You know, there's just so many things. So I really encourage you all to go to my IE Green website and see all of the events that are up there. There's a screening that the Human Impacts Institute is having on Monday, May 6th, called Paris to Pittsburgh. And this is a screening talking about real solutions in the face of climate change. This is put out by National Geographic. You can also get it on Netflix, I'm sure. But this is a nice time, again, to surround yourself with other people that are caring about the environment. And then there will be a discussion after to talk about ways that we as community leaders can actually help make a difference in climate. So that, again, is May 6th at the Spaceworks New York City at the Brooklyn Williamsburg Public Library. Also, May 9th, Greening School Food Forum is taking place. That's up in Albany, if you are in that area. And also on May 9th, there's a Riverfund Spring Shindig. And Riverfund is the organization, the food pantry that I partner with for my Christmas and Thanksgiving events. This is one of their fundraisers, and it's helping to raise money for their backpack program, where they supply over 2,500 backpacks to school children in New York City. So that's May 9th from 7 to 11 at the Bay Room in Manhattan on Liberty Street. And there's more. I'm not going to take the time to share them all with you, but please check them out on my website. The Farm Workers Fair Labor Act is really a big one that I want you to know about. And then, then I want to share my recipe with you. And this week, my recipe is a chili crisp. It is a condiment that my sister turned me on to, and it's just so good. And it's a traditional Thai condiment. You can buy them commercially. However, sometimes they have not great ingredients in them, like MSG, etc. So this is a homemade chili crisp, very easy to make and really worth it. So the ingredients you need are four small shallots, thinly sliced, two heads of garlic separated into cloves and then sliced, one and a half cups of vegetable oil, 2 3-inch pieces of cinnamon stick, 6 star anise pods, 1 2-inch piece of ginger peeled and very finely chopped, 1/2 cup crushed red pepper flakes, 1/4 cup crushed red pepper flakes, 2 tablespoons soy sauce, and 2 teaspoons sugar. And you're going to start by bringing the shallots, the garlic, the oil, the cinnamon, and the star anise to a simmer in a medium saucepan over medium heat. And you're going to cook that for a little while, reducing the heat as needed to maintain a gentle simmer and swirling the pot occasionally. You want the garlic and shallots to brown and to crispen, and that will take 20 to 25 minutes. But take your time. You don't want to rush it. You really want that to happen slowly so that they really get crispy, but they do not burn. And you want to basically drive all the moisture out of them before they brown. So just take your time with that. Mix the ginger, the red pepper, the soy sauce, and the sugar together in a medium-sized bowl. You're going to strain the shallot mixture over that through a fine mesh sieve and let that drain over the ginger mixture. And the garlic and the shallots, as they cool, they will crispen up more. And you want that to happen before stirring them back into the chili oil. And you can do this ahead of time, and it actually will stay in the refrigerator for a month and stay good. So it's really a wonderful, wonderful thing. And now I want to introduce all of you to my guest of the week, Dr. Peter Carter. He is a retired family physician who practiced medicine for almost 30 years, both in England and then in Canada. And he was the founding director of CAPE, which stands for the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. And he founded that in 1993. And more recently, he's founded the Climate Emergency Institute. Peter's a sought-after speaker on sustainable development, environmental health policy, and biodiversity, along with climate change and ocean issues, at international conferences around the world. And his new book, Unprecedented Climate Science Denial and Game Changers for Survival, documents the culpability of governments and big corporations in ignoring the science and marching ahead with greenhouse gas emission things such as pipelines, fracking, fossil fuel extractions, and industrial agriculture. And Peter's been following the global warming climate change research since 1988. And I'm really excited to invite him on to share with us his knowledge. Peter, are you with me?
To hear your voice and chatting with you again.
Hi, Peter. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining me.
So you can hear me all right, can you?
What's that?
You can hear me okay, can you there?
Yes. I can hear you fine, thank you.
All right, okay.
So I thought first you could tell us about the organization you started, the Climate Emergency Institute. Can you tell us a little information about that?
Yes, certainly. When James Hansen, you know, the world's top climate expert, longstanding, when he made a public statement in 2007, that we were in a state of planetary emergency, I really took that to heart because, as I say, he's not just the top expert on modeling and things like that. James Hansen's quite different. He's made himself into a multidisciplinary expert on global warming and climate disruption and ocean disruption. So he's pretty special. And I thought I was disappointed that he didn't get a huge amount of support from his colleagues. I found that very disappointing. And I thought, well, the fact is that, of course, as we all have known for decades, the first people to get hit from climate disruption and hit the hardest are billions of people in what we would call the developing world or the global south. And I thought, okay, I'll see whether I can get a climate emergency institute going by linking with people in those countries, activists, writers, and see whether I can get a little bit more of really what's happening to them. Because we just actually hear what's might be happening to us, you know, in the global north. So I started that, and much to my surprise, actually, it was a great success. And it also meant that I was doing more consultations and reviews for, UN departments, FAO, WMO, and those kind of important organizations to us. So it's been a good experience, actually, and although I've been a little bit impatient about, you know, why why I wasn't converting the world to understand, because the evidence was overwhelming years ago that we were in a dire planetary climate notions emergency. But over the past, over the past 6 months, it's been wonderful to see municipalities, cities, all over the world. And we got one just yesterday. Ottawa has in Canada now, our capital in Canada, has declared a climate emergency. And they're not only declaring an emergency, of course, they're actually doing something about it. They're hiring staff, opening departments, and this sort of thing. So, yeah, that's the story of the of my Climate Emergency Institute.
And can you share with us, how does your experience as a 40-year family physician inform some of your work with the Climate Emergency Institute? Have you seen the impact of climate change on people's health? Can you share that with us?
Yeah. I'm happy to say that although I think all our institutions are terribly backward and slow in getting this climate emergency across to people, I'm happy to say that the medical health profession, they've been the leaders in this for many, many, many years. So, particularly actually in England, where originally I come from, the Lancet, the famous, long-standing medical journal, has a continuous program on climate change. And also, particularly in the United States, the public health profession, they've been really, really excellent on climate change as well. So I wanted to mention that. For me personally, it's been a natural. When we started with CAPE, the Canadian Physicians Organization, we focused firstly on air pollution, and at the same time we ran global warming into that. And we still need to explain this to people. The IPCC. I'm an expert reviewer of the IPCC, and as everybody knows, it's.
Can you tell everybody what that stands for? I don't think everyone knows.
Yes, of course. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and their first assessment was back in 1990. So they're into their sixth assessment now. Most people, and including the media, are aware that because of the makeup of this big, huge IPCC body, their assessments are invaluable, but they tend to be understated, too conservative. So we started with what I was going to say was the IPCC and scientists, they assess climate change purely as climate change. Now, that's not the best way to assess it, and it's not the normal way to assess it either. On an environmental health assessment, you don't just assess the result of something. What you do is you assess the sources of the pollution. So the first thing that I realized and addressing this in a holistic way, which is natural to me because I'm a health professional, as you say, is to try and explain to people that, and this is standard practice, that in an environmental health assessment of a pollutant, carbon dioxide is a pollutant because that's because the concentration up in the atmosphere is way, way higher than it is normally. The pre-industrial level was 280 parts per million of air. The atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide is accelerating. It's accelerating now faster than it's ever done before, and it's now 410 parts per million of air. But the main source of death and disability and disease from the fossil fuel industry is air pollution. Air pollution from the fossil fuel industry every year needlessly kills millions of people. The number of deaths from climate change, which you then have to add to that, is in the hundreds of thousands. Now, there's more and more and more, and this is absolutely insane, and what I call certainly the crime of all time. There's more extraction of more fossil fuels going on now than ever before. Emissions of fossil fuel carbon dioxide increased last year by a huge 2.7%, increased the year before. And so what we're looking at here is, and as is beginning to, people are beginning to get aware, this is truly a survival issue now. If we allow the corporations who are financed by the corporate banks and the corporations who are encouraged, subsidized by our governments, if we allow this to continue, I got to say, we don't have a future. I started saying years ago as a sort of mantra that the only future we have no future with fossil fuel energy. The only future we have is with renewable, clean, which is everlasting energy. That is now totally true. We're right on the edge now. So
that's why you call your Climate Change Institute an emergency, is because of the emergency it is.
Yeah, it's an emergency for many reasons, and some of them still the public is not aware about, because the public has not been actually told the truth. The public, of course, is being confused by the denial campaign. But the public, as young people, are now becoming aware. You know, we have the school strike, which is an excellent thing, which is actually backed by the climate experts. They've all responded favorably to this. And, you know, I was just watching a little video last night again from Greta Thunberg, you know, the 15-year-old Swedish girl. And she's right. She says, you have not been telling us the truth. That's what she's saying. And she's saying, you've stolen our future, is what she said. And it you know, it's amazing that 15-year-old school children are more aware, apparently, and more prepared to tell the facts, you know, than people in my generation. But this is a very good thing. It's come late. But it's a very good thing that they are aware that this is an emergency. Now, there are two big reasons why we're in an emergency. One is a reason which affects the entire planet, and that is what's called runaway. And runaway is a game-over situation, not only for the human race, but for almost all life on Earth. And we have feared what we call runaway for decades in the environmental movement, because this is the single most terrible effect of global surface warming. Most people, I think, have probably heard that global surface warming is thawing out permafrost up in the far north and the Arctic. And most people will be well aware that the summer sea ice has been getting less and less and less and less. Now, these are two very powerful feedbacks. In other words, with our fossil fuel emissions and other emissions, we are our civilization is melting away the big sort of mirror reflecting of solar energy, millions of square miles, in the Arctic. So that's the cooling effect of the planet. That's the air conditioner of the planet, the scientists have called it. And that's getting less and less and less efficient. More and more and more solar energy is being absorbed into the now more open Arctic Ocean sea ice, which, of course, covers the Arctic Ocean. Now, what these two things do is, of course, they interact and they augment each other. So right now we have the three big greenhouse gases being emitted by the Arctic. And that is now adding to our emissions, which are sky high. This has reached such an extent now that the Arctic, which has always been a sink for carbon, the Arctic and the tundra and the greenery, which is a huge expanse in the Arctic too, that has also always meant that the Arctic sinks more carbon than it emits. But that has switched around. Research in 2016, which was reported, but the media really didn't report this at all. I couldn't understand that. NOAA, your National Atmospheric and Ocean Administration, they do what they call an Arctic Assessment on Climate Change every year. They call it the Arctic Report Card. And in 2016, they added up all the carbon which was being absorbed by the Arctic and all the carbon dioxide and all the methane which is being emitted by the Arctic. And they came to the really, really scary, awful conclusion that the Arctic has switched. It's emitting more carbon because of our global warming, because of our emissions, than it's sinking. So that's the one big one which you don't really, in a way, need to know anything else. But that is the public are aware of it. But the scientists really do shy away from that one, and I'm really critical of them on that. Now the other thing, though, is our food, right? So the other big reason for the emergency, and this is another one which has only been really gotten out there relatively recently, is our food security. So extreme weather events, of course, heat waves, that reduces crop yields. Forest fires, when they occur, they do. Now, drought, of course, is certainly the big one that reduces crop yields. And it's pretty well common sense, you know, that global surface warming, as it increases, is bound to increase the heat waves. And the IPCC finds that that's already started happening. Nothing is more certain than the fact that with more emissions and more global warming, we are going to get more heat waves, they're going to last longer, and they're going to be more severe. And that, of course, is already started to hit on our food production. Now, historically, the global north, the temperate regions, have had this really, to me, extraordinary idea that whereas the global south is going to be hit very badly, that the United States, Europe, and Canada, they're going to be able to ride out. They're in the temperate regions, and so their agriculture supposedly would not be affected. And even if it did, the assumption was that we have so much resources in the way of technology and science and finances that we can adapt to that. Well, it's for many years it's been very clear that that's absolute nonsense. I wrote a paper and presented it 8-9 years ago at the Potsdam Climate Institute, and I took all the research at that time on the projections for heat waves and for drought, but also for floods, of course, and severe storms, because they also can wreck crop yields. And I was able to show that Europe, in particular, because I was in Germany then, but also North America, and that means particularly the United States, is highly vulnerable to global climate change. I was very pleased to see, I don't know whether the media picked up on this one in the United States, but I was very pleased to see that the most recent your national climate change assessment, which came out just over a year ago, I think, they came to the conclusion that global climate change is going to reduce yields from the world's most successful best food producer, which, of course, is the United States. But that doesn't just affect the United States. That will affect the entire world. So that's the other big one. We're burning up future food is what we're doing now. The longer we emit, the more we emit, the less food we're going to have in the future. And, you know, the idea that you can move agriculture around, the experts acknowledge that this is absolutely a nonsense idea as well. The idea that you can adapt your food production to climate change, that's a very, very dangerous assumption. Obviously, people are already, farmers are already adapting, they're changing their practices. But, you know, you can't adapt to extreme weather events. You know, you can't adapt to a severe drought, which lasts not only for months, but lasts for years. So we have to take extremely seriously the, it's more than a threat now, the impacts of global climate disruption on our ability to produce food. Mm-hmm. So those are the two big ones.
And they are big ones. Let's take a couple of minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about climate mobilization and
good.
What's going on with that, and what your belief is in that. So everyone,
Okay. Don't
go anywhere. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Peter Carter from the Climate Emergency Institute, and we will be right back.
I'm Gary Knoll, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, will give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and Ayu Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with my guest, Peter Carter. He is 40 years retired family physician and founder of the Climate Emergency Institute, and we are talking about climate change. And right before the break, I asked him the question about movement, and can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, the climate mobilization is a great organization movement, and it's proving to be a great success story. I got in touch with the people, internet, putting some answers into an internet discussion that was going on. And the climate mobilization was started, of course, by just a few people. It's growing fast now. The leading light and expert on it is actually a psychologist called Margaret Klein. She lives in New York. She's now Margaret Klein Solomon, and she's quite a brilliant person. And she completely understands, which is rare, the realities, what you would call certainly the truth of global climate disruption. Oh, and by the way, I would be very remiss if I didn't thank you for having me on your program. But listening a little bit more to what your program was about during the break, to thank you very much, and because what we need more than anything is radio and TV and media to tell us the whole truth, what I would call now the terrible truth.
This my is pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely invaluable. So this is what happened with the climate mobilization. They got together. They started looking into the science and realizing that the public was not being told the truth at all. The public was not given the being given the impression that we were in a dire emergency due to these accelerating concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And they also noticed it didn't take the initiators very long to realize that this was a kind of bizarre sort of a policy that most of the scientists, not all, but definitely most of the scientists had, and also most of the leaders of the environmental movement had, of shying away, of actually avoiding telling the public the full truth. And I won't go into this in detail, but Margaret's done a lot of work on this. And, of course, it's just not true. The public have a right to know the truth, no matter how bad it is, and the public want to know the truth. And so they started a few years ago, I think probably 18 months ago. They started a city-by-city campaign of information on the climate emergency and the facts and what people had to do about it. They produced another one of their leader lights, Ezra Silk, who's also brilliant. He put together with all the information, he put together what he calls a victory plan. So they are they're tops. They're absolute tops. I would encourage anybody to go to their site, learn what they have on their site, and support them. I think probably many people will be aware that we have a wave now of increasing declarations, statements from cities and municipalities all over the world. And so the work that that the climate mobilization has been doing is certainly bearing fruit. And so this is the good story about climate change. The rest is all bad, and it's bad because we have been sort of socially engineered by big money, big bucks, lobbying, media, disinformation and confusion. We should have had, we would have had climate change dealt with decades ago. And I mean decades ago.
Yeah, well, I keep referring back to, you know, when Jimmy Carter was president, we had solar panels on the White House that Reagan came in and took away, you know. And if we had stayed with Jimmy Carter's trajectory, we'd be in a very different place right now than we are.
Yeah. In the States, in 1988, there was a bipartisan proposal, which was as good, if not better, of any political proposal anywhere on dealing with global climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're right.
Right.
And I can remember personally, there was an enthusiastic amount, certainly in North America and definitely in Europe, on we just sort of dealt with the dire threat of the stratospheric ozone depletion, and we seem to have won that one. And people wanted to move on and deal with and stop the global warming. Yep.
Right. Right. Can you talk to us about the Extinction Rebellion? What is that?
The Extinction Rebellion seemed to come out of nowhere. Very, very recently, it was started in a rural country area in England. Actually, where I lived as a boy, funnily enough, very close to where I was in England. And this was based on a similar understanding to the climate mobilization, in so much as these people that started this group in the UK, they also realized that we weren't being told the truth, they have been pretty vocal about this, saying that the big NGOs and the governments are absolutely not telling us the truth. It's far, far, far worse. The situation is far worse than any of our institutions, right, giving us the impression of at all. And they chose the right two words, because not only are we in the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet, and we have known that for years. Richard Leakey wrote his book, Sixth Mass Extinction, around 15 years ago. And that was a very, very comprehensive book. I reread it recently and left no question that we are in an extinction which is almost certainly the most rapid rate of species extinction that life on this planet has ever seen. Now, luckily, we're born into a planet which has more diversity of life, oceans and on land and in the air, than ever before. But we are really, really killing life off at an absolutely astounding, terrible rate. So that's one reason why they said we have to rebel. Governments are not only not looking after us, governments are harming us. They're potentially killing us. And so they also added to that, of course. And I think maybe we have our excellent Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, to largely thank for this. Because in May of last year, at the Austrian World Summit, our UN Secretary General made the statement, frank and open statement, that climate change, he said, is now an existential threat to the survival of most life on the planet, and, quote, particularly including humanity. So the first time he made such a statement, I couldn't believe it. the media. It wasn't carried by the media at all. I mean, this was incredible. But he made another similar statement a few years ago, and that got out. So Ban Ki-moon, you know, his predecessor, was absolutely great on climate change. And Antonio Guterres is taken up the torch, if you will. And he's not afraid to let us know how bad it is. So, yes, an existential threat to humanity means that our very survival is now at stake. And the big reason, of course, for that, or the two reasons for that, I've already mentioned, but the big reason, which he also mentioned just prior to the last United Nations Climate Conference in Poland last December, the Secretary General also said, if we don't reverse our emissions by 2022, in just a few years, he said we're looking at the risk of a runaway. So we're sort of staring at oblivion, is what we're doing, and that's using a term that Ban Ki-moon used in the Copenhagen summit. And we need we really need these groups. Because it's very, very clear that our governments they're not in league. They're not looking after us as citizens. Our governments are working along with and supporting the fossil fuel industry and the investment banks that are now, fossil fuel industry, fossil fuels obviously were great for a long, long time. But like any poison, when you get carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at a level which is no longer going to be healthy for life on land and life in the oceans, ocean acidification is accelerating at a terrible rate as well, then, of course, you have to stop using that energy and you have to switch to all the clean, renewable energies that we've got. But because the governments and the main media and the power of the corporations is relentless, we are really not making any progress at all in reducing our emissions because, as I say, this started in 1990. You know, it was... In 1990, we were formally aware that global warming was a very, very serious threat. And the first assessment of the IPCC, which I cover in our book, Unprecedented Crime, they had it all. They had it all down there in 1990. So no wonder, you know, people were highly concerned in the late 80s and early 90s. And what's happened is that the national emissions targets, which are filed with the United Nations, they have to, and luckily the October 2018 IPCC assessment on the 1.5 degrees C limit stated this very clearly, we have to get our emissions down immediately. Global emissions have to start dropping immediately. And the only way that this is going to happen is if we have a big, big, growing, effective social movement. And so that's where Extinction Rebellion is, and that's also where, particularly in the United States, where our climate mobilization is. So it's a rebellious movement on the streets. There's no alternative but to be doing this, because literally, the survival of the human race is now at a very, very high degree of risk, and I can say that because just from atmospheric carbon dioxide, just from that alone, let alone the methane and the nitrous oxide as well, which is where, of course, food choices come in, The WMO says that the level of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration is the highest in 3 or 5 million years. I agree with the WMO, the World Meteorological Organization. They're really, really good, actually. And but it's actually higher. There's a paper just been published that we're at a 12 million year high. You know, these I know their numbers, but they show how criminally insane this situation is.
Well, I remember, Bill McKibben, when he first, you know, started 350.org, yeah. It was, you know, if we hit 350 parts per million of CO2 into the atmosphere, we're doomed. And now, as you said, we're at 410 parts per million. It's just incredible that our governments are ignoring this and acting like, you know, business as usual is just fine and that we're going to survive, or that innovation is going to, you know, step up to the plate and we're going to come up with great inventions that are going to reduce all of this. And that's just not going to happen.
Well, our governments are—they're into pushing the worst criminal enterprise that there's ever been. Look, when we're in the sixth mass extinction, when we're having life and species being lost at an accelerating rate already, you know, from cutting down rainforests and degrading lands all over the planet. And we are, our governments are pushing us, right, to produce more and more and more fossil fuel emissions. This is an absolute evil. That's what this is. I mean, there's no other word for it. Destroying life, as, bless him, the Pope Francis said, it's a sin before God. It is indeed. And it's a most terrible evil, it, for heaven's sake, you know, it's our own children, you know, whose their lives are being robbed, are stolen, as Greta Thunberg said recently in the UK. These very young people, and I gave a presentation recently to a school of young high school students. There are really big hope, but it's terrible to say that our children are our big hope, right? We're now having to look. They also realize, Greta said this, and others have told me personally, they know they have a hell of a time in front of them.
You know, it's very sad to say, I know so many young people who are choosing not to have children because they're so freaked out about the future and they don't want their children to have to deal with it. So,
and they're quite right.
You know, that in itself is such a sad situation. I mean, to think that, you know, my daughter being one of them, you know, is going to miss out on the miracle of being a mother because she is so freaked out about the world. It's terrible.
And how about this for an awful irony? As I've indicated, our leading institutions and most of our leading scientists on this topic have said that, they've told me, I've argued with them, that you must not tell the public things which will be too frightening, because you'll just shut them down and they won't be able to deal with this, which is, there's no basis for this whatsoever, you know. As a medical doctor working in the emergency department, people with terminal illnesses, I know this better than anybody else. Now, here we are, right, with young children telling us that we should be panicking. Mm-hmm. So, hopefully we, my generation in, you know, who has lots of money, you know, most of my generation has done pretty well when you're talking economics and finances. So hopefully we're going to be quite embarrassed by the fact that it's the young people that are out there, children that are out there, telling the truth that we have not had the guts to say. Hopefully we'll be embarrassed enough to join with our children and say, yes, you're right. We're in a terrible, unprecedented emergency, and we have to, I call this the issue of all issues of all time. It is. It's the biggest issue by far that humanity has ever had to deal with. Lands, forests, lakes, Arctic, permafrost, the oceans, all of it.
It's so huge, and that's why, you know, I'm always telling people, you know, it is up to all of us. We all can't fix everything, but we all can do something. And everybody joins a movement towards turning things around. We need to make movements loud. And right now, enough.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, that's quite true. I mean, you know, increasingly I get people asking me, you know, well, is it too late? You know, it's the question that sort of annoys me. Obviously, it's not too late. It's never too late. We still have a beautiful planet that we can see, right? But also, it's not too late because this is what we're good at. Human beings are very good at uniting together and taking on impossible odds and actually prevailing. So
Peter, I don't want to cut you off, but we're just about out of time. So I wanted to just plug your book. If anybody out there, you know, I've been talking with Peter Carter. His new book is Unprecedented Crime, Climate Science Denial, and Game Changers for Survival. You can get it on Amazon. You can find it in your local bookstore. And Peter, you want to share with everybody your contact information if they want to
get in touch
with you?
And they can find me at climateemergencyinstitute.com, and there's an email there, and please get in touch with me. We've got to talk
I'll
this
share
thing
your
up.
Email information, have information all on my website as well, okay? Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us. Everyone, I've been talking with Peter Carter, founder of the Climate Emergency Institute, and I'm Bhavani at IE Green. Have a great rest of the week. And I will see you all next week. Peter, thanks so much for joining me.